Our next section is going to be on risk assessment and auditing. And this is where I actually start giving you the formulas for calculating risk. It's great that I keep telling you risk, but how do we actually put a number on it? How do we actually start calculating and getting something that we can compare, analyze, and work against? So before we get in to our risk assessment and auditing, any questions or comments on BCP-DRP, on the business impact, on putting together and validating your plan? Excellent. So if there's no questions, let's go ahead and look at risk assessment and auditing. When we look at risk assessment approaches at a high level, there's two general strategies: quantitative and qualitative risk assessment. Quantitative risk assessment is where we go in and we put exact numeric values on every single risk out there. Now, quantitative risk assessment is very good for business decision-making purposes. Why? Exact numeric values translates very nicely to money, which is what executives understand and think. So quantitative is very good for business decision-making purposes because it directly relates to monetary impact to the business. While it's great for business decision-making purposes, it's not great for security purposes. And I'll explain first. If I have to go in and come up with an exact numeric value for every single risk in our enterprise, this is going to take a long time. This could take 9 months to do. Now, if I'm taking 9 months to go in and figure out all the risks, that means I only have 3 months left to fix the risk. Shouldn't we be spending more time on fixing the risk, not all the time on identifying the risk? If we're spending all of our time on identifying the risk, we're still at risk. We need a model where we can analyze quickly and spend most of our time on the implementation. So that's problem one. Problem two, if I'm spending 9 months calculating the risk, what's the problem? By the time I get done, it's no longer accurate because risks are always changing and always being altered. So if I go away for 9 months to do these calculations, by the time I get done, it's not accurate because the threats and vulnerabilities have changed within that time period. Finally, the reason we don't like quantitative is, do I need to know an exact numeric value for every possible risk in my environment in order for me to effectively fix it and address it? No, what do I need to know? What are the top items? I need to know what are the top 8 or 9 items, then I want to fix them and then recalculate, fix them and recalculate. So because security is always changing, we want a methodology that can adapt quickly, identify the high priority items and be repeated at a high frequency throughout the year. That's what qualitative risk assessment is. Qualitative is where we go in and we put a general quality, high, medium, and low, or 1 through 5. In my experience in control system environments, when we do qualitative risk assessment, we actually like 5 levels. I found that high, medium, and low doesn't give me enough granularity, and 1 through 10 is too much granularity, and we end up arguing over silly things. So I found that 1 through 5 tends to scale the best. So now with qualitative, we're doing this very quickly. We're literally going through and saying, is this a 3? Is this a 5? Is this a 2? Is this a 4? Is this a 5? Then when we get done, we take all the 5s, we fix those, and then we recalculate what are the new high items. Fix them. What are the new high items? Fix them. So now qualitative, we might be doing every 6 to 8 weeks, multiple times a year, constantly identifying the high priority items and then addressing those in our business. So qualitative is going to be the big driver because it's just focusing on the high priority items that we want to fix and address. Now that's well and good, except one problem. What do we have to do with our plan? Present it to the executives, and the executives like quantitative data, not qualitative. So how do we go in and take our qualitative risk assessment process and adapt it to information that the executives can comprehend? Here's what we do. I use qualitative to identify the top 8 to 10 items, and then I do quantitative analysis against those 10. Because I'm doing quantitative only against 10 items, it's going to be pretty quick and fast. And now we're getting the executives what they need without spending a lot of time or energy. So qualitative is identifying the high area items, and then quantitative puts it in an executive format so we can present it to the leadership. And essentially what that's going to look like is you're going to create a spreadsheet that says, what is the risk, likelihood of occurring, cost if it occurs, and cost to fix it. And then that's what we present to our executive teams. So when we're doing our risk methodology, we always got to go in and look at likelihood and impact. What are the things that could happen? How bad? How often? How much accuracy do we have? Remember, risk requires uncertainty. We don't know what the future holds. So we're not going to get it right. We want to get it close. So we have to ask ourselves, how much accuracy do we have in the information? How much confidence do we have in the data points? If you go in and you give me 12 years worth of historical data, I can give you a pretty good accurate picture of what potentially is going to happen in the future. If you give me 4 weeks worth of historical data, I'm going to have a lot less confidence in my calculations because I just don't have enough data to really get a accurate snapshot or reliable snapshot of what could happen or what could occur. So the way we calculate risk is we start off with the single loss. We go in and ask ourselves, what is the asset value and what is the exposure factor? And we multiply them together. So with single loss expectancy, I'm saying how much is the asset worth and how much of it would be lost if this event occurs. And that's our single loss. Now, I don't want the single loss. I want the loss for an entire year, which means I'm going to take the single loss. I'm going to multiply it by the annualized rate of occurrence. And I'm going to get my ALE. So the ALE, the annualized loss expectancy, is the single loss times the annualized rate of occurrence that gives us the big picture impact. So question. Yes, so when we go in and we talk about the asset value and then we talk about the exposure factor, what makes this a little tricky is we're not just talking about tangible assets, we're also talking about intangible. So for example, if there is a fire or if there is a flooding or major problem in your data center, you could go in and say the physical replacement cost of a PLC is X amount. But we all know that if that PLC is not available for 3 weeks, that there's going to be operational loss, there's going to be reputational loss, there's going to be other things that impact our environment. So yes, when we come up with what is the asset value, we are trying to put into play both the direct and indirect losses that could occur in that cost factor. So that includes both direct and indirect. Now, I know that sounds difficult, but here's why it's something that's achievable. When we're looking at the asset value, we're not looking for exact numbers. What we're looking for is number of zeros. Is it 10,000? Is it 100,000? Is it 1 million? Is it 10 million? So a great example is a client calls us in because they were struggling with your exact situation where they were trying to decide what an asset in their operational center was worth. And somebody was like, well, it's technically 200K. And they're like, no, that's the replacement value. And somebody said, well, it's probably more like 600 or 700K. No, it's probably 400K. So they couldn't decide. So I went in and I took the four numbers their folks came up with, averaged them, and said, okay, every one of you has to pick one of these, which is closer to your answer. Is the loss 50K, 500K, 5 million, or 50 million? And they all pick 500K. Boom, let's move on. That's the level you're looking at. So we're not trying to argue between 400K, 500K, or 600K. What we're really trying to figure out is this closer to 50, 500, or 5 million. We're looking at the number of zeros. And when you put it in that perspective, then it's more straightforward to add in intangibles to get a better perspective. Your execs, you and your IT staff might argue over whether this is going to be 50 million, 60 million, 70 million, or 80 million worth of reputational damage. I don't care. What I'm going to ask you is it 5 million, 50 million, or 500 million? And you have to pick one. And I bet you most of them would agree on the 50. So by looking at that rounding error at that level, that's why we can still go through and do this. We're looking at number of zeros, general categories of asset value, not specific dollars and cents, because that would be too difficult and hard to do. So the way we start our calculation with our single loss is by going in and determining what the asset is worth, and then how much of it would be lost if this event occurred. So for example, if we had a conference company and they were going to run a conference and they were planning on making $100,000, that's the asset value. And there's a terrorist event where 50% of the attendees can't travel. What is the single loss? Well, it's the asset value, $100,000, times the exposure factor, which is 50%, which would be a $50,000 single loss. Now, that's great that that's the single loss, but what do we want to know? What is the total loss for the year? Because this event might only occur once every 10 years, so it's actually smaller per year, or it might occur 10 times per year and be much larger. So we need to have that leveling. And that leveling is called the annualized rate of occurrence. So we're going to take our single loss expectancy, which is the asset value times the exposure factor. We're going to multiply it by the annualized rate of occurrence. And that's going to create our annualized loss expectancy. Now notice that ARO is what I call the stabilizer, because it can go in and it can either increase or decrease the value. Let's look at two examples. We had a utility company we work with on the East Coast of the United States. And if you follow the news, 2 years ago, we had a superstorm that hit the East Coast and just totally clobbered and took out a lot of organizations. This organization with Superstorm Sandy had $8 million worth of damage to their infrastructure, their plant, and their facility. So their folks went to the executives and said, we need to spend $4 million a year to make sure this doesn't happen again. And their general math was, we need to spend $4 million a year to stop an $8 million loss. Now, basic ROI will tell you that's a good investment. Problem, that $8 million was a single loss. It was a single loss factor. If you follow storms on the East Coast of the United States, superstorms hit approximately once every 9 years. It's almost like clockwork. I used to live up there, and literally every 9 years, boom, you get clobbered, which means the annualized rate of occurrence is once every 9 years. That means the annualized loss expectancy was 8 million times 1/9, which was really more around 900K per year loss, which means you want to spend $4 million a year to stop a 900K loss, that's a bad investment. That's a bad return in order to spend your money. So that's an example where the ARO actually diluted the value because it was something that occurred at a low frequency and only once every 9 or 10 years. We also have cases where the ARO could be a multiplier. So let's look at another example. We have 1,000 employees and 25% waste an hour a week surfing the web, and the average salary is $50 an hour. So if we go in and take $50 times 250, the single loss is going to be $12,500. Now, how can we go in and stop the unauthorized web surfing? I could buy web filtering proxies. A web filtering proxy is going to cost me $100K. Does it make sense to spend $100K to fix a $12,000 problem? No, that's silly. Because even if the problem occurs 2 or 3 times, it's still going to be cheaper than spending $100K. So you're not going to spend $100,000 to fix a $12,000 problem. Issue, it's not a $12,000 problem. $12,500 is the single loss. That's the one time. Assuming they take 2 weeks holiday a year and they work 50 out of the 52 weeks, the annualized rate of occurrence is 50. Now, you ready for this? Ready for the multiplier? We're going to take that little itty-bitty $12,500. We're going to multiply it by 50 and look at what the annualized loss is. Almost $750,000. You would not spend $100K on fixing a $12,000 problem, but you absolutely would spend $100K on fixing a $750,000 problem. That's the power of the ARO. It can add a huge multiplier or, in my previous example, a huge diluter based on what we're talking about. So we always calculate that single loss, and then we must multiply it by the annualized rate of occurrence. That's the stabilizer to see what the annualized loss expectancy is going to be. Question. Typically, you're going in and looking at historical data for your organization and looking across the industry to see what's happening to other related environments. So for example, with my utility company example that I did, we went back and we looked at 70 years of historical weather data and saw that literally on average every 9 years they have a superstorm. So we use 70 years of historical data to come up with that annualized rate of occurrence. In the case of the web surfing, we went in and looked at the HR records to say, how often do people take time off? How much holiday do they take? And how many times are they going to be working the year? So we go back and we look at historical data to be able to get an idea of the frequency of how often this could occur in the future. And remember, when we're calculating these numbers, they're not exact values. We're trying to get in the general range so we can get an understanding of what level of severity we're dealing with in this value. Okay, but how are you going to come up with the statement that based on global warming or other factors, that storms are going to occur more frequently in the future? You're going to use the historical data to see that. You're going to go back and look at 70 years ago, it was every 12 years. 50 years ago, it was every 10 years. 30 years ago, it was every 7 years. So if you're going to make a statement that based on weather patterns and other factors, that the frequency of storms is increasing, you need to show me the data. So you're going to have to go back to the historical data to show me that that frequency is increasing. Remember, with security and calculations, everything is driven by data. So if you have data to support the statement that storms will occur more frequently in the future, then show me the data. But remember, that data is going to have to be real data, which will always be historical. Future data isn't reliable. Past data is. So you would use the past data to do the future modeling. So you would still use the historical data to adjust or alter those numbers. Very often in security, we forget our role. We go in and we pick a dog in the fight. So we go to our executives and we say, we must go and lower our risk to this level. You must give us all this money, blah, 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 blah. And the executives don't agree. And then we get frustrated and we get upset. Our role in security is not to determine the acceptable level of risk for our company. That's the executives. Our role in security is to be an honest broker. So what we should be doing is we shouldn't be going into our executives and saying, we need 800K for all these solutions. What we should be doing is going into our executives saying, okay, here are the top 11 risks. Here's the risk, likelihood of occurring, cost if it occurs, cost to fix it. And we recommend that we fix the top four items. But your Mr. or Mrs. Executive are the ultimate authority, so you decide what level of risk you want for your environment. They might be more risk aggressive and do less. They might be risk adverse and do more, but you're the honest broker. So we should always go in with a recommendation of what we think they should do, but we have to remember that's not our decision. It's the executive's decision to ultimately decide what is or is not that proper level. We also want to make sure that we always do cost-benefit analysis. Make sure that there's a good return for spending the money in that area. And this is one that some security people sometimes struggle with. It is sometimes more cost-effective not to fix a risk. It is sometimes a better business decision to let damage occur to an asset than to actually try to fix it or minimize that associated risk. If you have an asset that costs $30,000 for you to replace, and in order to reduce that risk from occurring, it's going to cost you $200K, that's a bad business decision. Because even if it occurs, you're going to save money. I'd rather lose $30K than lose $200K. So you always want to understand what is the cost if it occurs and what is the cost to fix it, and make sure that the cost to fix it is significantly higher than the cost if it occurs. Otherwise, it's better to accept the risk than try to spend unnecessary money on reducing it to a level that's going to cost you more at the end. Once again, there's lots of regulation around risk-based assessments. There's methodologies of critical cyber asset. Once again, each utility area has different terminology. So in nuclear, we call them CDAs, critical digital assets. In electrical, they call them CCAs, critical cyber assets. So that's why I went into our sheet and I just said, what are your critical assets? I didn't get into the term because it'll vary across country, location, and industry. Whatever you call them, it's going to always, in any model, you're going to have to identify what your critical assets are, and then you're going to do risk-based analysis against those critical assets. And you want to always go in and make sure that you have clear definitions of what is or is not a critical asset within your environment. In the nuclear arena, many countries carefully regulate nuclear power because nuclear power is a very clean, efficient way of generating power, but it can also be very, very dangerous in place. So, for example, in U.S., we have several regulations on controlling and managing nuclear power. The idea is to make sure that you have a detailed identification of where your critical assets are and what needs to be protected. So we need to go in and make sure we have a cybersecurity program. We identify the critical assets. We align the security plan against the physical security plan. We work with supply chain and we conduct training and awareness. What's nice is regardless of what country you're in or what regulations, that's really the approach you need to take. Notice, you're figuring out what your acceptable level of risk is with your security plan. You're tying it to your critical assets. You're recognizing that cyber can't exist in a vacuum, so you have to tie it to your physical security plan. And you recognize that you alone can't do this. You are heavily reliant on your vendors. Your vendors can help you a lot in this area. So you need to team with them. And the big area that you need to focus in on is supply chain management. It's great that you're buying a product from Company A. But if Company A is buying a product from Company B, and Company B is buying a product from Company C, and Company C is buying a product from Company D, if I'm an adversary, I can go after any four of those. And if I can embed in, we have an issue. Well, in a lot of cases, the prime doesn't do validation of all the suppliers, so somebody can inject in malicious code, backdoors, or other problems earlier on in the manufacturing process. Also, it's becoming an easier target to get in. If we look at typical supply chain management, if you're buying a large controller from a main vendor, that vendor probably is a $1 billion company. They probably have thousands of people on their security team, and they probably spend millions of dollars on security every year. But if they buy some of their supplies from this vendor, who supplies from this vendor, who supplies from this vendor, who makes a specialized chip, and this company five levels down only makes that specialized chip, so they have 100 employees, and they only make $40 million a year in revenue. Question, how many dedicated security people does a 100-person company have? Maybe one. How much money is a $40 million company spending on security? Maybe 200K. So my question is, if you're an adversary and you want to break into somebody, are you going to break into somebody who has a 3,000-person security team with an $80 million security budget? Or are you going to break into somebody who has a one-person security team with a 200K budget? I don't know about you. I'm going after them. So that's the challenge that we're seeing now, is because there's so many sub-vendors of sub-vendors that verifying and checking the supply chain becomes a very important process to do. And the way I always look at security and regulations is security needs to drive the focus, but regulation sets the guardrails of what level of depth they need to go into the process. The reason I do it that way is because security is focused on risk, and the regulations determine what risks are or are not acceptable. The problem with the alternative is letting compliance drive the work, is compliance is not focused on risk. Compliance is focused on a prescribed list of things to do. You could technically be compliant and not be secure. Why? Compliance needs to be written in a way that it can scale to a large number of organizations. Therefore, it tends to be pretty general. And if you don't have a risk-grounded approach, you might be technically meeting the spirit of the regulations, but not the intent. I'll give a great example. Most of the regulations within nuclear environments says that if you have CDAs in place, critical digital assets, they must be separated from the network, either an air gap or an approved data diode, to only control information flow out for monitoring, but no information flow in from an exposure perspective. Great. There is nothing in there that talks about verifying alternative data paths and alternative data lines. So technically, if I have a data diode, but then I have an alternative communication path out of it, technically I'm compliant by the spirit, but I'm not compliant by the intent, because they can't cover every possible option. Also, a lot of the regulation says you must have a multi-tiered environment that has firewalls separating, doing two-way filtering between each of those different networks. However, because organizations are so different, there is nothing in the regulations that talks about the rule set configuration for those firewalls. So do you realize I can have a firewall with 372 rules that are equivalent to any allow? And that technically meets the spirit, but not the intent of the compliance. However, if I let risk drive and I go in and say, okay, having a firewall that's equivalent to any allow is way too high a risk. I need to go in and filter more traffic. And then I let compliance determine the guardrails of how much I filter. Now I end up with a compliant solution that's secure. So that's why we typically want risk to drive our analysis, and then compliance sets the guardrails, and now regulations is doing what it was intended to do. Regulations was never meant to drive the security program. It was meant to determine the scope and depth based on the risk analysis that you perform within your environment. So regulations is going to provide that validation point in our environment. So if we go in and we look at the key milestones that we want to accomplish, we want to figure out what our controls are. We want to put out guidance for implementing those controls. We want to create alternative controls if we need augmentation. We need to document everything that we did, and then we need to validate and implement our overall strategy. Everything we've been talking about, and the way I usually break it down, is I like going even a little simpler than this, which is the critical assets, the threats, the vulnerabilities, because that's directly tying to risk. You can do this many different ways. I'm trying to show you on this slide. There's a lot of different ways to get there. I just like to do what I think the simplest, which is the minimal number of variables, which gets us to the same point. But as long as you can go in and come up with a strategy to be able to secure, protect, and validate those critical digital assets, that's really what it's all about. And that's really what we need to focus our energy and effort on. So you need to go in and once again, think of this slide as a sample. I'm not going to get into the details of the regulations because many of them are US specific. But the point is you need to figure out all of the regulations that apply. You need to look at the common thread across them, and then you need to go in and figure out what the lowest common denominator is. Now, I will warn you, having done this in a lot of countries, in some countries, when you look at all the regulations that you have to be compliant with, you will have conflicts. You will have ways that there will be no possible way to meet all of the compliance because they contradict each other. I'll give you an example. If you look in the nuclear arena, there is regulations out there that says all critical digital assets must be totally isolated from the rest of the network with only informational data flowing over a one-way data flow, but there is no possible way that you can access or manage CDAs from any remote location. Everything must be directly accessible, local with physical separation. That is one regulation that you must follow. There's another safety regulation that says because of the safety issues, if there's leakage in a nuclear reactor, the safety regulation says you must be able to turn off and control the CDAs from remote locations because if there's leakage and it's not safe for humans to be at the local plant, you better make sure that you can get in remotely to be able to manage, control, and lock down to minimize even more safety issues. Well, guess what? You have to follow both of them. You can't. They contradict each other. One says you cannot ever access remotely, and one says you must be able to access remotely. So this is some of the challenges we get into in regulations is because you have different regulating authorities, they're going to often not always play nice. Now, the question I get from students is, how do you go in and handle that? The way you handle that is you assess the risk and you recognize that you're going to have to do part of both, and you come up with a risk mitigation plan where you're documenting the reasons why you're not following the regulations and the overriding reduction measures that you're putting in place. So now when somebody comes in to go in and verify, you can say, listen, I'm not following this because of this reason, and this is a bigger risk than this, but here's the mitigating plan we put in place to control that. And in most cases, the inspectors will analyze that and say, yes, that is an acceptable workaround. We will allow you to not be compliant in that specific area. But you need to lay that out. You need to lay out all of the regulations that are there, any of the similar terms to determine overlap, similarities, common denominators, and any conflicts that might exist in those areas. You also want to always make sure that you put dates around your approach, because that's going to drive the dollars from the executives. If you go in and you say, here's our approach, well, guess what? If I'm going to do it in 3 years, 10 years, or 30 years, that's going to be significant different in money. So you need to put dates to drive the implementation, map it around your policies, and make sure that you have proper training in place to control and manage what's occurring and what's happening. As we mentioned, a lot of this not only can be done by vendors, but the vendors want to do it. They want to go in and participate and help, because if there's an issue and a problem, the vendor gets just as bad publicity, if not more, than the entity. I'll give you an example. Stuxnet, pretty visible, pretty open attack vector. What vendor was involved? We all know the vendor name, right? Unfortunately, I'm not saying they were at fault. I'm not saying they did anything wrong, but unfortunately, everyone quickly knew that that was associated with a Siemens S7 system. So that's why a vendor is your best partner, because they recognize that even if it's not their fault, they can still have the reputational damage and they can still have that reputational impact. So they can do a lot of the work and analysis for you. So if we look at the key building blocks, I did it for nuclear, but you need to do this for whatever industry you work for. What are the core pieces of your program? What are the core areas that you need to go in and focus your energy and effort on? So everything is tied against risk. You want to tie in physical. You want to tie in all regulations. You want to have proper incident response. You want to have proper program management. You want to work with your vendors on the supply chain, and you want to tie everything back to the critical assets that are in place within your environment and your organization. So now we've gone through and we've added a little more flavor on risk. You now know how to calculate risk with single loss and annualized loss expectancy. You know that qualitative is the main driver, and then quantitative is what we do to present the information in a form that's acceptable to the executives. So now that we've gone in and we've looked at how we calculate the risk, we now want to look a little bit at password controls and authentication within our environment. Before we get in to password management, are there any questions, comments, or concerns on anything we went over? Excellent. So with that, let's go ahead and jump in to password management. By the way, one of the best, most effective ways of making sure you have reliability in a classroom is daisy chaining multiple power strips together. That's a really, really good thing to do. So now you have 8 points of failure, right, if anything goes wrong there. So I always love how we do that, where it's like boom, 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 right, all those daisy chains. By the way, I think we're trying to go for the prize, and I'll let you in on the contest. Right now, with all my clients, the winner that I've ever seen at one of our clients' data centers is 17 power strips daisy chained together. Can anyone beat 17? Okay, I always want to, I want you guys to have a chance to win the prize. By the way, that's not a prize you want to achieve, right? So, we go in there. So, yeah, I was literally in there and I'm counting and I'm like, 14, 15. I'm like, you gotta be kidding. And then the best part is I go back to the first one in the chain and I go to pick it up and it's really hot. Like it almost burnt me that hot to the touch. And I went to the engineer there. I'm like, I think you have a problem. I said, first, you're not supposed to daisy chain power strips. I said, but that power strip is really, really hot. He goes, yeah, we know that. I'm like, well, do you think you should fix it? Then with a straight face, he looks at me and says, oh, is that a bad thing? Let me help you out here. Heat leads to fire and fire is bad. So yes, if your daisy chain and your power strip is very hot to the touch, yes, that's a bad thing. Right? The fact that you have to tell people that was a little surprising to me. But evidently I informed them and we fixed the issue. But yeah, you want to be careful with how many of those you daisy chain together. So we're back in business. So password management, we talked about AAA this morning, authentication, authorization and accountability. On systems, we want to be able to prove that someone is who they say they are, give them the least amount of access they need to do their job, and hold them accountable for their actions. One of the common ways of authenticating in control systems is still passwords, because it's an easy, scalable way to be able to access and log in to systems and facilities. What's also nice about passwords is they are defaultly built into most equipment. Even equipment 15, 20 years ago typically supports basic password login. And passwords are things that if you have a field technician and they need to get in to do work, they can call somebody, they can tell them the password over the phone, and they could be able to get in. So for various reasons, from an availability functionality perspective, passwords do scale well in this environment. Unfortunately, the fact that you can easily give passwords, share passwords, and utilize the same passwords is not necessarily good from a security perspective, but nonetheless, passwords tends to be a common method of authentication in HMIs and field equipment and a lot of the diagnostic equipment that's out there. Now, if we look at sort of the mix and match between IT and control systems, in IT, we try to go in and make the password long, complex, change regularly to make it hard to guess. Remember, the general idea of a password is a pretty simple concept. If I have something that no one else knows, then it's valid form of authentication. But if somebody else knows my password, then they can hijack, take over, and cause harm to my account. Therefore, in order for a password to be effective, we need to go in and limit the chances that somebody else will be able to figure it out, limit the chances that somebody can guess it, and if somebody does guess it, limit the risk by changing it at frequent intervals. In an IT arena, that tends to scale. So in IT environments, we tend to be focused in on 15, 17 character passwords, letters, numbers, and special, change every 90 days. So we minimize the risk. We minimize the exposure. You can't reuse any previous passwords, and we fully encrypt the passwords on the servers. That's well and good, but several problems in control systems. One, if you're going to be going in and you want to have accounts that you can log into multiple systems using the same account, single sign-on, which is a necessity typically in control systems, because if you're going to have somebody remember 30 passwords, they're going to make them all the same. So we tend to, in control system environments, we support centralized single sign-on with solutions like Radius, TACAX, Diameter. This is where you have a centralized authentication database that you can use to log in to many devices using the same credentials. Well, question. If I'm going in and I'm going to use the same credentials to access many different devices from many different vendors, I'm going to have to use the lowest common denominator. So if I have some devices that support 12-character passwords, some devices that support 10-character passwords, and some devices that support 8-character passwords, what length am I going to have to use? 8, otherwise I can't log into those devices. Now what happens is it tends to be a little worse than that. You tend to have 10,000 systems that all support 15-character passwords. You have 300 systems that support 10-character passwords, and you have 30 systems that support 6-character passwords. Well, those 30 systems are still important enough, but they're 10 to 15 years old, so they're legacy. So now you have to go in and make your password length 6 characters. So you tend to have limited length. Also, complexity is not something that many of them support. If you go in and you let my password be letters, numbers, and special, what does that mean? The keypad that I use must support that character set. Well, if you're going in and you're logging in to this device, you might only have numbers. You might have a limited keypad. So if you now go in and my password contains a special character and it's not available on that keypad, I'll never be able to log into that device. So that, once again, adds complexity that a lot of these specialized devices do not have a full keypad. And then you're limited based on the entry components that are in that device. Then you want to be able to log in to all those devices based on issues and problems. Therefore, changing a password is not an easy thing to do. Because if you have a field technician who has to log into a lot of different devices, and you now start changing those passwords on set intervals, that's going to also interrupt the functionality. And then finally, the real big one is some of these specialized field devices only have 2 or 3 accounts that you can set up. They can't support 50 or 100. Some of them have a single administrative login and that's it, which means you have to do shared accounts. There is no other way around it. You have 2 options. If you have a field device that only allows 1 administrative password and that's it, your 2 options are either A, you have a single field technician who's the only one that can support that device with no failover capability, or you have to tell multiple technicians the same password. Which option are you going to pick? You got to go with that one. There's no way from an availability perspective you're going to have that single point of failure. So that just adds a lot of the complexity. So based on the specialized devices and the age of these devices, we are often very, very limited in the capabilities that we have available from a password perspective in the ICS land. So now the idea of a password is, if I know something and the server knows something or the device knows something or the field unit knows something and no one else does, if I present that information and it matches what you have, I can log in. Therefore, the premise of authentication is, this something that I know and this something that the device knows has to be stored in a secure manner. Well, for the human or operator, what storage capability do they have that's fairly secure? The human brain. And I say fairly, some people I run across this is a little more secure than others, but relatively speaking, this is fairly secure mechanism to store that password. So we store them up here. What's the issue? Our computers don't have this. Our computers don't have a brain, which means we have to store the passwords encrypted on our system. Well, if you remember this morning when I talked about symmetric asymmetric and hashing, which one of those do you think fits best for passwords? It's got to be hashing. Here's why. If I have a secret, my password, that I don't want anyone to know, so I encrypt it with symmetric or asymmetric encryption. Now I have a key that no one can know. Did I really make forward progress? No. So I started off with a password that I don't want anyone to know. I encrypt with symmetric and asymmetric, and now I have a password that I need to keep secure. Well, how am I going to secure the password? I didn't really make forward progress here. So therefore, because symmetric and asymmetric are reversible encryption and require cryptographic keys to be stored, they don't scale well for protecting our passwords. However, cryptographic hashing does. Remember, cryptographic hashing is a one-way transformation that's irreversible and doesn't require a key to do the transformation. So I literally can take my password, run it through a cryptographic hash, and store that on the system. But Eric, if it's irreversible, how do I ever get it back? You don't. Then how do I ever authenticate somebody the next time if I can never figure out what their original password is? Easy. I take their original password, I hash it and store it on the system. Then the next time you log in, I ask for your password again and I hash it. The only way the outputs are supposed to be the same is if the inputs are the same. So if I take your password and I cryptographically hash it, and then you enter in your password and I hash it and they match, you're in the system. If they don't match, you're not that user. So that's a scalable solution. What's the problem? That leaves an opportunity for an adversary to potentially hack those systems. If I can go in to your system and get the cryptographic hash, I can then do a brute force attack where I try every possible combination, and when I match your hash, I get in. Now, yes, when we're talking about 15-character passwords that are letters, numbers, and special that are changed every 90 days, that might not be feasible for an adversary because it would take them 200 days to brute force your password, and it changes every 90, so by the time they brute force it, it's no longer going to help them out in an IT arena. What's the issue here? In control systems, our passwords are shorter, we have limited characters, and they don't change that often. So now, not only will it allow me to crack these passwords quicker, but when I do crack the passwords, I can now have access for years instead of just days or weeks into that given system. And there's also another problem. Those cryptographic hashes are stored pretty securely on your Windows Unix boxes. So if you go in Windows, it's the SAM database. Unix, it's Etsy Shadow. You need root or admin access in order to get control of that info. However, when you're talking about a lot of this field device and others, you can actually just lift the passwords off. Remember the lab on day two. At the end of the day where you went in and you looked at the EEPROM and you looked at the entropy to find where that key was, password, same thing. An encrypted password can be found in that manner. So now if I can get access to one of your field devices, that would also allow me to get in to that system. So what we're trying to aggressively do is move away from passwords. While passwords are fairly easy and cheap and low cost to do, they are not very secure at all. So what we're trying to do is move towards more smart card authentication tokens where you have to have something in your possession, either a little token that will generate passwords every 60 seconds or an access card that you would put in a system or scan a box in order to access it. And now by having something you have, it makes it really hard for somebody to brute force or get access. Now, what's the problem with tokens? People can lose tokens. People can drop tokens. In one case, and I don't know why my customers always feel the need to share with me all the details, but I had a CEO call me up who was traveling and in fairly explicit detail explained how his token fell out of his pocket while he was in the restroom and got flushed down the toilet. And I'm like, sir, with all due respect, you could have just told me you lost it. I could have slept much better at night without the visual that you just laid out for me there. So you don't have to give me the details, right? You can just say you lost it and I could be perfectly okay with that. But for whatever reason, you can go in and lose those tokens. Then you can't log in. Also, tokens can be stolen or taken. We've seen this if you like movies. And a lot of these movies where they want to get into a facility, so they'll be in a crowded area and they'll bump in and steal the person's access card and use it to get into the building. So there are drawbacks. Therefore, what we like to do with tokens is two-factor. Something you know and something you have. So you have a token or you have an access card, and then you have a 4 or 8-digit PIN that's used to be able to go in and access that specific area. While this is where we'd like to go, we're dependent on the vendor support to build that into the systems. Now, this is an area where a lot of the vendors are doing a real good job. They are increasing their capabilities in this space. Now, tokens can be lost and tokens can be stolen. So the even better method is biometrics. A biometric is where you're using a physical attribute of who you are, a handprint, a facial scan, an iris scan. Now, what's nice about biometrics is I could go in and forget my password. I could leave my token at home, but I'm not going to leave my eye at home or my head at home or my hand at home, right? It's with me all the time. So therefore, it's a more reliable method that's always with me. Also, contrary to Hollywood movies, it is much harder to steal your biometric data. Most of the biometric readers today look for signs of life. So if you actually go in and cut off somebody's finger or pop out their eyeball, I know, great discussion before afternoon break, it's not going to work on modern biometric systems because they actually check for blood flow, heat, and other signs of life to make sure that's working correctly. The issue, biometric readers are very expensive and loading up the biometric data can be fairly difficult. So while we might be able to use biometrics in the business network or even the supervisory, when you're talking to remote field devices and other areas, biometrics is still a long way out because of the expensive implementation and the uploading of all the user data in order to support that and allow that to work correctly. So we are seeing more and more vendors moving in this direction for the supervisory control, the business network, those areas, but some of the remote field devices, that's going to take a while in order for that replacement to happen and occur. We also talked about single sign-on. So we don't want to have to go in and remember 30 accounts with 30 passwords. I want to be able to go in and have one account and one password and log into many different systems. Now, there's two types of single sign-on, and it's very, very important to understand the difference because they're significant in the security exposure. There is traditional single sign-on, which is literally you log on once and you can access all the resources in the entire environment. That is very dangerous. That we don't recommend, and here's why. If we're using traditional single sign-on, I walk up to my computer and I log in, and now, because I logged in, I have access to all the applications, all the systems, everything. If I walk away to go get a cup of coffee, and somebody comes up to my computer because I'm logged in, they can open up all the different applications, gain access to all the different resources, and cause significant amount of impact to your environment. Very, very dangerous and not what we want. So therefore, what we recommend in control systems is hybrid single sign-on. Hybrid single sign-on is you have a single set of credentials, but you reuse them to log into each application that you want to access. So now every time I want to access an application, I use my same credentials. So I only have to remember one set of credentials and I use them over and over again for each application. But here's the benefit. Now, if I log in to the system and I walk away and somebody comes into my logged in console, now when they try to access applications, what are the applications going to say? Please enter your user ID and password. Please enter your user ID and password. And because the person is trying to hijack, they don't know what that is. And now the amount of damage is greatly, greatly reduced to the exposure within your environment. So while in the real IT world, they still use the traditional single sign-on, in control systems based on that risk of access to so much information, we like hybrid single sign-on where you have a single credential, but you have to re-log in each time to limit the hijacking and exposure by a third-party adversary. And then, of course, because this is our governance day, there's lots of regulations that talk about password complexity, handling and controlling and managing passwords within our environment. So now that we've briefly introduced passwords, how we do hybrid single sign-on, and some of the newer technology like biometrics and token-based, we're now getting into our last core module before we do resources, which is incident handling. And this is when we're going to walk through that tabletop exercise to show you how that works. However, before we do incident handling, any questions or comments on password management? If not, I'd actually like to take our afternoon break a little earlier, because incident handling, I want to cover it in its complexity. I don't want to break in 15 minutes. So let's go ahead. It is 2:40. Let's take our 15-minute break. We'll come back at 2:55, and then we'll finish up what we started, incident handling, do the quick walkthrough, and then give you some resources that are available.